Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Killer Podcast. My name is Freya Millard.
And I'm Emmy Woodcock, and we are your hosts. So, guys,
it's episode 10!
Final episode!
Oh my god, we're here! Wow!
We've made it.
I can't quite believe it. I have enjoyed this season so much.
It has been a good one, to be fair. There's been a lot of interesting cases that we've never heard of before.
We've had to learn about a lot of things we perhaps didn't know before. The burning questions, they've been hot.
We've done them this time properly.
We've consistently did
so
them.
So proud of us.
If we can do them today, we've nailed it.
Oh no, I haven't done it for today.
No! It was so close.
I'm only joking, guys.
It's so exciting. I hope you guys have listened to the 9 previous episodes. What have we had?
God, I can't remember that.
Episode 1, we talked about a bathtub murderer.
Oh, yes.
Episode 4, we also talked about a bathtub murderer.
Oh, yes.
Then there was a parent killing child scenario. There was
children killing parents.
The faking your own death scenario.
That was a good one. Yeah.
That was a good one.
Oh, evil grandma poisoning people.
And the firefighter and the nurse and their tragic demise.
Oh, yeah. All the way back in episode 2.
Yeah.
Oof.
Crazy.
That was a while ago.
So much has happened. If you haven't listened, what do they need to do?
They have to go back and listen to them all.
Have to.
It's just the law and you have to follow it.
Yeah.
So today, it is me to finish off the season.
Ooh,
again.
Yeah.
So yeah, I finished it off for last season. If anyone remembers the final episode from our last season, a bit of a alien conspiracy and our good friend Alan, who just needed some sunshine.
Oh, Alan.
You know?
Did he get that sunshine?
I hope he got it.
I hope so too.
But then again, he's in the UK, so probably not.
Yeah, that's true actually.
We struggle for sunshine.
Alan, share your sunshine.
Exactly. Well, for this time, we're on a very different journey from our alien conspiracy of last season.
I don't know. I feel like you could link it to aliens, Amy. You were very convinced of linking every case to aliens that season, so I think you'll figure out a way.
I'm always on the conspiracy side, you know? Can't help it.
We do know.
It's the aliens or the raccoons.
Or the pigeons.
What else is mixed?
So you think this one can't be linked to aliens, or is there like a slim chance?
I can't say that I thought of a connection with aliens.
That's good then.
This is actually a bit of a hometown journey for us, as this story takes place in our home county of Shropshire.
Oh,
in the lovely West Midlands. Woo!
Big up the West Midlands featuring on a murder podcast. What a good goal.
Yeah, I was gonna say, we don't want connection with this.
Yeah, it's very like backwards, isn't it? Oh yeah, my home is connected to this grisly murder. You're like,
yeah, this is not what I should be sharing.
But it is.
I thought it would be quite nice to end on a close to home story. And fun fact, actually, my mum's cousin was a superintendent in the West Mercia Police at the time, and he was involved in this case. So yeah, it's very close to home.
That is really close to home.
I know.
So what is the case?
The story I'm telling to finish off this season is the story of Chris Foster. Chris Foster was a 50-year-old man. He had a wife, Jill, who was 49, and a daughter, Kirsty, aged 15. Random fact about Kirsty was that she was horse obsessed. That was in every single article I read. It was like, the horse obsessed daughter. And I was like, that's so cute.
Aww. In Shropshire, that's kind of a given, isn't it? With all the fields. It's farmer central, isn't it?
That is true. We are quite a horse place.
We are.
So yeah, they lived in a huge house. A 3-story mansion, to be exact.
Damn.
Which is in the village of Maysbrook, which is just on the Welsh border. So Maysbrook is said to be mainly large Georgian mansions, and it's mostly made up of self-made millionaires. So it's not quite the area of Shropshire we're from.
What are you talking about?
It's a little bit higher class.
Amy, I am at the highest class. Fallopian high class over here.
Yeah, we're definitely self-made millionaires around here.
Yeah, our school didn't get shut down the year that we left. It didn't fail and burn.
No, absolutely not.
Very fancy.
But yeah, so we're in the nicer area of Shropshire, because there are some very, very nice areas of Shropshire.
That's true.
Chris was known for being a loving husband and devoted father. He'd even got his daughter some horses because she loved them so much. But some articles I read actually said that he had 8 mistresses.
Shit.
I know.
That's a lot.
And it is also believed that his wife Jill had affairs, but I don't really know if that's true. But yeah, so it just kind of shows, like, on the outside it all seems lovely. You know, loving husband. But on the inside, things are never as they seem. There was a part of Chris that was not happy. He did not like being still and always needed to be doing something. It was said that even when he was at home, he would always be cleaning or fixing things, even though they had a housekeeper. He still was just like, no, I have to be doing something.
I bet that housekeeper loved that job. He's like, I'm getting paid by these rich folk to do fuck
honestly,
all.
Honestly, yeah.
Yeah, man. I want that job.
So he said that he spent $50,000 on landscaping his property and over $200,000 on furnishing his house with antiques.
Ooh.
I'd love a good antique in my house. That'd be well nice.
That is fancy.
He made his money in the oil business.
Mm.
In 1987, Chris was just an ordinary bloke from Burnley with a sales job in Wolverhampton. The next year, the Piper Alpha oil platform explosion killed 167 men. When Chris saw this, he invented a new chemical formula for oil rig insulation.
He heard about this incident and then decided to fix the problem. That's quite a nice thing to do.
Yeah. So a quote by Chris's brother was, Chris saw this tremendous opportunity. He saw Piper Alpha in flames. He put everything into it. He took the risk. It's one thing Chris was. He was a risk taker. I think you've got to admire him for that and making it work. He's made a lot of money. I mean, at one point, you know, he was bringing product in, he was putting a label on it and sending it out the door, making 50, 60% plus markup. It was a license to print money.
Damn.
Basically, his brother's like, he was making money.
He was making money. Sounds like he's got it all.
Yeah. So Foster called his invention Olva Shield, where other oil rig insulation burst into flames. Using Olva Shield formed a safe, crisp shell.
Mm.
So, yeah, he did a pretty decent job.
I mean, I don't know much about the topic of oil, but from what you're saying, it sounds like top notch.
It's not going to burst into flames. It's pretty decent.
Yeah, what you want?
So, yeah, a lot of the big oil companies began placing orders. So he started making a lot of money. This is when, you know, their life started to step up a little bit. You know, Chris and Jill were going on many first-class holidays, living the dream.
Ooh.
They moved from Telford to Maysbrook and into their £1.15 million home.
I mean, I get moving from Telford. I do get that. That is a step up.
True. I just love this quote about how they got this house, right? So it was said that Jill had been shopping in Sainsbury's. Don't know why we had to know it was Sainsbury's, but... She was in Sainsbury's and she picked up the Shropshire Life magazine, and in there was a house that she fell in love with, which was this house. So the next morning, Chris put an offer in for the house.
Yeah.
I know, right?
That is big balls move, that is. That's a lot of money to play with.
It really is.
It's like, I hope this is good.
I mean, if I went to Daniel with a house, I'd be like, oh, I like this one. He'd be like, fuck off.
He's like, go on, buy it then.
Yeah, go on then. You sort it out.
Yeah, it doesn't work like that.
No, sadly not. So yeah, Chris started to collect classic cars. He had two his and hers Porsches, an Aston Martin, a 4x4 for his wife with personalised plates, Jill 40.
Oh, that's tragic. Sorry. But
I know.
I can't. No.
Oh, personalised plates. They're interesting, aren't they?
I feel like rich people must get to a point where they just have too much money. Like, I don't get what you're like, I must have my his and her Porsche. I must.
Yeah. I mean, goals.
I don't know. If I ever got to a level where I was excessively rich, I just think I would still live a pretty modest life. Like, oh yeah, I'm chilling. I just want to buy some like M&S food sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Maybe afford a house. Just like a nice 3-bed would be sweet.
Just somewhere we like.
Yeah. And then the rest, I don't know, donate it, make some projects, do some wild shit.
Yeah. Well, some people have strange hobbies, and his was collecting classic cars.
Yeah, I want to personalise all the license plates on my vintage cars. Fair enough, mate. I just think you could be wilder. You could do more with your money just to do wild shit.
Yeah. I was going to say, well, if it makes him happy, but obviously it didn't, so.
Did it not?
No, it did not.
What would you do with your money, Amy? What's the most outlandish thing you'd do if you were mega rich?
See, I can't even think of anything outlandish. Like... All I'm thinking about, like, I just want a house with a swimming pool in it. That's what I'd want.
In the UK?
Like an indoor one.
That's, yeah, there we
not
go.
Not an outdoor one. That's too wild for here.
That is wild. At least you would have to pay for refilling the water, though, because rain will do that for you. Smart.
That's true. Just swimming in rainwater.
Sounds pleasant. It really does.
Yeah. To go with all his cars, he had 3 horses and 4 dogs. And to complete the image, Jill even owned doves.
I didn't know you could own doves.
I don't know. Apparently she had doves.
Was she a magician?
Maybe. But while his insulation invention was award-winning, it wasn't making that much money. Chris was living on credit.
Oh.
He was like spending all this money, but he couldn't really afford to.
Shit, that's bad.
And to add to that, Chris started to behave quite dishonestly.
Oh.
Bum, bum, bum. So in 2003, Chris had entered into a contract with a company called DRC to manufacture his invention exclusively. In 2004, he'd be worth $10 million, but by 2005, he was spending more than he had.
How can you get to that rich and not know how it works, you know? Don't spend more than you have.
Honestly. In desperation, Chris sourced a Californian supplier to manufacture his product for cheaper.
Dodgy.
But DRC, who he was supposed to be with exclusively, found out. They was like making it for him, but they now couldn't sell it because he was trying to get it made by somewhere else. So DRC decided to sue him.
That's fair.
And they won. Because of this, DRC took over his like ownership of the product. And they made it a global success. But obviously now he wasn't getting anything from it anymore.
Oh no.
So yeah, that didn't go well.
Well, don't try to betray your business partner then, because that's on you, man.
Yeah, exactly. In September 2007, his company went into compulsory liquidation and a $3 million freezing order was put on his assets.
What's a freezing order? What does that mean?
So I'm assuming that means he can't use it.
Okay.
I think. I could be making that up.
We'll go with it. It sounds good.
Yeah. And then on top of all this, he owed the Inland Revenue nearly £1 million.
Ooh.
He didn't pay any VAT or national insurance or indeed any tax of any kind. So he owed them a lot of money.
I am shook.
Whoa.
Rich people not paying their tax. No, that never happens. I don't believe this.
I cannot compute. So, you know, he basically lost control of everything.
Yeah.
And he was left with nothing to do but stay at home.
I mean, it's not the worst place to stay.
Exactly.
Your nice £1.3 million mansion or whatever.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty nice. Chris had a hobby, and his hobby was clay pigeon shooting. This allowed him to own guns.
Oh.
Just to say.
No.
And of course, Chris being Chris, he spent over £12,000 on a shotgun and £8,000 on a 3-day shoot. As you do. Yeah.
What? Is this just like one gun and one day trip?
Yeah, it's like one gun and then 1 3-day trip.
He's on £20,000.
He spent £20,000. Yeah.
Damn. To live like that.
Honestly. And whereas most hobbies are used to be relaxing, you like reading a book or painting, Chris couldn't relax. He always had to come first, you know, do more than everyone else. And apparently his wife used to say he was a control freak and he had to be in control of things totally.
Yeah, that sounds like not a fun guy to be around.
No.
He's always got to be the winner.
Yeah, and now he's like losing, basically.
Yeah, lose with grace is always my way.
Not everyone can do it.
If you just never expect to win, it's just a delight when you do.
That is true. So obviously at this point, you know, Chris had pretty much lost everything. So a friend that was concerned for him texted him asking if he was okay. And Chris replied, "Not really. I think everything's coming to a head for me."
Oh.
And he also told others that they should look after Jill and Kirsty if he topped himself. But they all thought he was joking.
I mean, that's not something anyone jokes about, really, is it?
Well,
it
depends on your circle, I suppose.
Someone's like, "Oh yeah, look after my family if I kill myself." I'd be like,
"Ugh." Like, "What? I want to get some help, my dude."
Yeah, like, no. If she'd said like, "Oh, look after them if something were to happen to me," that's a bit vague, isn't it? It's like, oh yeah, yeah, so you just want to be prepared in case an accident or something.
Yeah.
But to like explicitly said, "In case I kill myself," it's a bit like, he might be planning something.
Yeah, you'd think.
You guys don't have a laugh. This isn't a joke.
Yeah. By the end, Christopher had remortgaged his home 3 times. He had 20 different bank accounts. One of them was overdrawn by £330,000. And he was facing personal bankruptcy. He obtained antidepressants in the spring of 2008 because he went to his GP.
Yeah.
And he admitted to feeling suicidal.
There we go.
And he confided in a business associate that he'd rather take his own life than lose his family home. He said, "They're not having my stuff. I will top myself. They will carry me out of the house in a box."
Ooh.
So the man was going through some shit, you know?
He is going through a lot, but like it seems very materialist.
Oh, yeah.
So surely he could clear all that and still live quite a comfortable life if he just sold the house.
Yeah, but it was like, no, this is mine. No one else can have it.
Yeah, they can't take it. I know I'm in all this debt, but they can't have what I've bought.
Yeah, exactly. So then a strange event that occurred in July of 2008. Chris was parked up in his tractor, and for no reason, he decided to reverse the tractor. Minutes later, a massive branch broke off and it crashed down just where he had been parked. And they said, like, if he hadn't have moved, he would have been hit by that and he would have died.
Wow.
Yeah, and the fact, like, he didn't have any reason for moving back a little bit. He just did.
That's scary. That is a near-death experience.
Yeah. Which just makes me think, like, if, you know, he hadn't have moved,
yeah,
the next bits of the story wouldn't have happened. It's weird. It's a weird thing.
Just had an impulse to move.
Yeah.
Can I suggest aliens were involved?
Maybe the pigeons whispered to him.
Like in Alan's story, remember how he said he got, like, moved out of his vehicle?
That's true. Maybe.
Mm.
See, now who's the alien person?
It's me. I'm the alien person.
And then in August, Bayliss pinned a letter to the gates of the house, basically saying, like, we're coming for your stuff.
Not my antiques.
Yeah, the precious antiques. So it's not known by this point if Christopher had planned what would happen on the 25th of August, 2008. Mm. It was a bank holiday Monday. Chris, his wife Jill and daughter Kirsty attended John Hughes' mansion. He lived in their neighbourhood. So he was also, you know, fancy pantsy up there.
Mm.
So he was holding a barbecue and a clay pigeon shoot.
Oh, Chris loved that.
And we know that Chris loves that, yeah. So they sort of like spent their afternoon like with friends, barbecuing, shooting, you know, casual.
Good times.
When at one point, Chris turned to Jill and said, I've had enough. I want to go home. Despite Jill wanting to stay, they returned and Jill went to bed first. His daughter, Kirsty, chatted to a friend online. One of the friends she was chatting with was a 16-year-old boy. At 11:30 p.m, she sent him a text message on her phone saying she was sorry she had to leave the online chat as her father had turned the internet off. 45 minutes later, at 12:15 a.m, she sent him another text saying, night, night, love you.
Aww.
Kirsty then went to sleep. So both his wife and his daughter have gone to sleep.
Yeah.
Chris then fitted a silencer to a .22 rifle. It is likely Chris shot his wife first.
Oh.
Because she's more likely to have been able to overpower him.
Yeah.
So they think that's why he did her first. And he shot her in the back of the head.
Jesus.
I know. He then crossed the hallway to his daughter's room.
Oh.
And then he also shot his daughter in the back of the head. It was as if he was, like, too ashamed to look them in the face.
Yeah. Was his daughter still asleep at that point as well?
Yeah, they were both fast asleep.
Oh, yeah. Of course, he had a silencer, didn't he? So he didn't wake her.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. Following this, Chris then calmly set about destroying everything that could be burnt. It is estimated that he flooded his mansion with 200 gallons of oil.
Ooh.
To ensure the fire took hold. At 3:09 a.m, CCTV footage showed Chris set fire to his home. He then went about killing all of the animals.
Oh.
He shot dead the dogs and the horses.
No.
I know. Horrible.
Just why?
I don't know. It's like almost like they're his property as well.
Yeah, he's got some sort of possession issue, doesn't he? He can't let anyone have what's his.
Yeah.
What he feels entitled to.
Definitely.
His wife, his child, his dogs, his antiques.
Yeah, all his furniture and
his home.
Yeah. So next, he jammed the horse box against the entrance gate and shot out the tyres. This was to prevent anyone from being able to drive in and, like, intervene.
Wow.
He then returned home. As the flames burnt through his house, he lay down next to his wife. He brought a loaded gun with him, but he did not shoot himself. Instead, he died by smoke inhalation. So he just literally, like, lay down next to her and just waited to die.
Damn.
I know.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Kind of risks potentially burning alive. I don't know. It's like, what's your preference?
But I think that's what his mindset was. I think it kind of gives a hint to it.
Yeah. Otherwise, you take the gun as like a mercy killing for yourself in a way that you don't want to feel the burn.
Yeah.
So you shoot yourself, but he decided against that.
Yeah, he just lay there.
Interesting.
Mm. The neighbours, obviously, you know, seeing a huge fucking fire, rang the emergency services.
Yeah.
The first fire crew arrived at 4:29 a.m, but they first had to try and move the horse box out of the way. By the time they can get close enough, there is little they can do but contain the scene. So it was quite frustrating for all of, like, investigators because vital evidence was being destroyed, but they couldn't do anything about it because it was already too far.
Yeah, and I imagine, like, he knew what he was doing. You know, he obviously works with flammable materials and...
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it sounds very strategic, the plant, the horse box and then the house, making sure that the entrances were hard to enter from and all that.
Yeah, he knew what he wanted to happen. 4 days later, the ruins of the house were still smouldering.
Jeez.
You know, it was still going for a few days. And then finally, on the Friday, investigators decided to enter.
That's so long.
They found two burnt bodies together. So it was later concluded that this was Jill and Chris and that they had died on the same bed. And it had actually collapsed 3 floors down to the ground.
Oh.
Because the house was all burning. So it like just fell through the ground.
Yeah, you can't do anything to stop it.
And then on the following Monday, Kirsty's body was found. So she wasn't found for like a whole week after.
Was that just because her bedroom didn't fall through and it was so hard to get up to it?
I don't think so. I think it pretty much all fell through. It's probably just there's so much stuff, you know, you've got to go through it all.
Yeah, and he had a lot of antiques.
Yeah, exactly. And then I think this is so sad. On the Tuesday, the bailiffs arrived because they were unaware that anything had happened. So they'd like turned up as they were supposed to like repossess stuff. So it was like he'd left them nothing.
Yeah, I bet that's a hard thing as a bailiff to feel like you might have been not responsible. Obviously, they're not responsible, Chris is, but...
But, like, you kind of have that feeling of, like...
Because you are doing your job and you're part of a system higher up than you that demands that you go to that house and collect what is owed. But obviously, that spurred on him to do that to his own family, his daughter, his wife. Like, those bailiffs are going to feel, like, awful, but that
yeah.
It's not their fault. But, you know, you're just part of the system. But then he decided to do such an extreme thing.
Yeah, definitely. In total, 12 fire crews dealt with the fire, and it took investigators 7 days just to remove all the bodies. They also found spent cartridges and a gun fitted with a silencer in the ashes. So on the 2nd of April 2008, a 2-day inquest started. Those present were able to watch the house CCTV between 3:12 a.m. and 3:49 a.m.
Mm.
A crime reporter that was there said the footage was unbelievable. You could see what he was doing and it was like something out of a movie. So the CCTV captured the shooting of a horse.
Ooh.
It showed him setting fire to the stables and it showed him driving the horse box that he used to block the emergency services. And many who watched it commented on how calmly he'd gone about.
Wow, so it's just, he was on a mission. He was a man on a mission to get a job done.
He literally was. It was just like, just doing it, like, as if it was a normal task.
I mean, to have that plan, like, I'm going to shoot them, and then I'm going to kill the animals and move the horse box. It seems, like, premeditated, but then I guess, was it, like, 2 hours difference between when he shot them and when he started moving everything?
Yeah.
So I wonder if he did shoot them impulsively. Or just had, you know, spur of moment, woke up, I'm going to shoot them. And then maybe just for the next few hours, just tried to decide what's next. What do you do now?
Yeah, possibly. So the coroner ultimately recorded that Chris had killed his wife and daughter before killing himself. And it did reveal that both Jill and Kirsty were definitely asleep when he shot them.
Oh.
Which is like...
No idea.
Yeah, but then it's almost like at least they didn't have to experience it, I suppose.
Yeah, it seems very much like a, not a mercy killing, but like an assassination as such, like very precise. What he wanted to get done was done.
Yeah. The coroner also recommended that as Chris was a gun owner and he had warned his GP of his suicidal feelings, that from now on, GP should be informed if any of the like people they treat have a gun license.
I mean, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, because it could stop these tragedies happening in the future.
Absolutely.
Like if you know someone who's got these feelings and then they also own guns.
Yeah, you can get them away from those guns because
yeah.
You don't want to put themselves or anyone else at risk.
Exactly. Yeah, so I thought that was quite interesting. Jill and Kirsty were laid to rest on 19th of December 2008 and they had a separate funeral to Chris. He was buried like a few hours later.
Good. Fuck that guy.
I know, right?
Did anyone attend his? I feel like...
I'd be surprised, but it didn't say anything.
Yeah, I hope that they're buried very far apart.
Yeah, definitely. The site where the family house was has since been cleared, and in 2012 the property went up for sale, and it was actually bought in 2014, but I found no further information of if anything's actually been done with it yet.
Ah.
But yeah, so they cleared out, obviously, because everything was burnt down.
Yeah, start fresh.
In this one article, I read like a really interesting interview done with a friend of Chris's.
Mm.
So Ian said, "What Chris did has put thoughts in my own head, I must admit." The interviewer asked, "Sorry?" Ian said, "I empathise with Chris and I feel guilty for empathising. Don't get me wrong, there's no way I could harm my children, but I'm going through a divorce at the moment, it's looming. I probably seem normal and relaxed to you, but inside I'm finding it very stressful. My chest is real tight. I get this pain down here. And he points to his left side.
Damn.
The interviewer asks, what's the point in keeping all of that stress hidden away? And Ian replied, we're supposed to be manly. We're not supposed to get upset. We're supposed to be the breadwinners and the providers, especially in our children's eyes. We're supposed to do miracles.
Yeah.
And I think that was just like kind of summed up men thinking, like having that idea of like, oh, I have to be strong, like can't be seen crying.
I suppose it's a good reflection on what, because obviously Chris isn't here to talk about his own mental state. So it's a little bit of an insight into what he might have been.
Yeah, exactly.
Feeling or thinking by someone who's, like he says, in a similar situation, similar pressures.
Yeah. But yeah, so that was the story of Chris Foster and our home, like, home county story.
Wow, it's the first time we've ever brought a home county story to the table.
I know.
And it was very interesting.
I hope I did it justice.
You did. I didn't. I think I remember vaguely hearing about it, but I did not know all those details.
It's such a sad case. It really is.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's sad because it's such unnecessary deaths. I mean, it just did not need to happen.
Yeah.
But I do think the psychology of this whole case is probably one of my areas that I find truly fascinating. So it's quite a one to think about, isn't it?
Well, I think that can lead quite nicely into our burning questions.
Yes, absolutely.
So, Freya, my question for you is, what is the psychology behind a family annihilator?
Ooh, I like that this is my final question of the season because it is definitely the area of criminal psychology that I am personally most captivated by. So it feels quite nice to finish on a real interest point for me.
Yeah.
So to most of us, it seems like one of the most bizarre things a human could be capable of doing. You know, it goes against our innate biology to wipe out children that we've brought into this world. And when we hear about cases like this, it tends to be the ones that seem like a very random outburst that was not expected.
Definitely, yeah.
So like the perpetrator was not known to the police as violent. But of course, that's not to say that all family annihilators don't exhibit violence towards their loved ones prior to the killings, because they definitely can do that. And that can definitely be the case because family annihilators vary quite a lot in terms of their psychological motive to commit such a hideous crime. I'm going to talk you through some of the research behind family annihilators and the categories they tend to fall into. In 2013, a study published in the Howard Journal of Criminal Justice examined reports of familicide from 1980 to 2012, and they found a total of 71 cases.
Doesn't sound as many as you'd think.
That's it. And you think 71 cases in 33 years, you know, it's not a very big sample size to make assumptions off.
Yeah.
But the reality is, in this situation, that family annihilation is quite a rare crime, even though when it does happen, they get a lot of attention in the media.
Yeah, I think that's probably why it seems like there should be more.
Yeah, absolutely, because when one happens, it's a big central focus point for a lot of us. So
yeah,
you just have to look at Chris Watts at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a big case that everyone's fascinated by because it's such a recent one. And I think people think it happens more than it does, but it is still a rare incident of murder.
Yeah.
But yeah, in the study, they found that out of the 71 cases, 59 of the incidents had a male perpetrator, and over half of the cases involved someone between the ages of 30 and 40 years old.
Mm.
How old was your man, Chris?
He was 50, so he was a bit older.
Ah, but he had a lot of triggers, didn't he, at the time?
Yeah, I think it all depended on like the things that actually happened in his life.
Yeah.
That set him off, really.
57% of the cases occurred within the family home in the study, and the most common method of the killings was stabbing at 32%, followed by carbon monoxide poisoning at 15%.
Stabbing is such like a personal way to kill someone. That's horrifying.
Absolutely. I think another study I was reading about said that shootings are more common overall, though.
Yeah.
Does feel very like, ooh, angry killings, stabbings.
Yeah.
Which might make sense as I go a bit further on into it. 68% of the cases, the male family annihilator would commit suicide after the murders, which leads on to my next point, that trying to comprehend the motive of family annihilator is quite difficult. Firstly, because like I said, it's a rare type of crime anyway. And then secondly, because usually when it does happen, the perpetrator kills themselves straight afterwards, taking any information about the motive or their psychological state to the graves with them, which is exactly what happened with Chris here.
Yeah.
We can't know exactly what was going on in those 2-3 hours, you know, when it all happened.
Yeah, what was going on in his mind, yeah.
This just leaves us to speculate about what their motive was and what was going on without getting any of the confirmation we might hope to have gotten. Because it is something that a lot of us can't comprehend, and the only people that can really explain it are the ones that do it.
Yeah, you want to be able to ask them, like, why? What are you thinking?
Yeah. So four common factors in family annihilations is firstly the breakdown of the family, so i.e. a divorce or custody disagreements over the kids.
Yeah.
Secondly, financial hardships, which is what happened here.
Yeah.
Next, cultural honour killings. And lastly, mental illness.
Yeah, I didn't even think about the, like, cultural honour killings. That's a good point.
Yeah, it tends to be in situations where a family member may feel that relatives are moving away from a culture or a religion and not upholding values that they deem that they should be upholding.
Yeah.
Adding to this, a recent 2019 literature review on the topic by Carlson et al. Found family annihilators fit into two core categories when it comes to what motivates them. So, first one is despondent type. They kill the family as part of their own suicide. So, like, killing because of financial struggles, because they perceive it better for the family to all die with them and avoid the shame or potential hardships that follow.
Yeah.
Spot on for this, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. That's exactly what this is.
They basically believe that the family is just better off dead than without them. And like you said in the story, like, he was sort of saying that.
Yeah, he was pretty much telling them, like, I'd rather die than have all my stuff taken.
Yeah, including my family that I feel ownership over.
No, exactly, yeah.
Then the second type is a hostile killer. They're usually jealous, possessive. They tend to kill the family for revenge or out of spite. So this is where the divorce may be a trigger, as a family annihilator may have the view of, if I can't have my spouse and my family, then no one else can. Or if my ex is going to reduce my custody, then I'll show her by killing the children. So it's rage-driven.
Yeah, if I can't have them how I want them, then no one else can either.
Yeah, it's very much they want to inflict pain on someone else by doing this. As you can tell by the types of motive for these familicide crimes, the psychological profile of a family annihilator also varies greatly. In 2017, research from the University of Finland examined the background of family annihilators, and they found that they are usually highly educated men with psychological problems such as depression, self-destructive tendencies, and substance abuse issues. There is also a high prevalence of violent behaviour and unsteady social relationships. That's why I'm saying that it isn't always that they don't show signs of violence.
Yeah.
It can be there. And ultimately, sometimes they might have shown signs of violence and still not be known to the police. It could have just been a family that knew those signs.
Well, exactly, yeah.
So who's to say that Chris never showed signs of violence if his wife and child, who could have spoken on that topic,
never told anyone.
Yeah. Some research into the characteristics of family killers by criminologists at Birmingham University, so a bit closer to home again.
Hello.
In 2013, they found that there were four types of family annihilators. So the first type is a self-righteous killer. So this is along the lines of a hostile motive, where the killer wants to blame their partner for what they are about to do because they broke up the family or undermined their status as head of the household.
Mm.
This might involve the family annihilator ringing the partner up prior to the killing of the children so that they know what is about to happen and that they can't stop them. It's very much like, because of what you've done, I will now have to do this absolutely abhorrent thing to hurt you, and now that's your fault.
Like trying to pass the blame.
Yeah, they want to make sure that the pain stays with their partner or whoever they're trying to get back at.
Yeah, that's horrible, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very spiteful. The next one is a disappointed killer. So the killer here believes that the family have not lived up to his vision or expectations for them and believes they are deserving of death for this.
That is dark.
So this may be where a cultural killing takes place. So the killer may kill the family for not following along with their religion or customs, like I said.
Yeah.
Is it John List, the one that killed them because he felt like they were straying from God?
Oh, yeah. I think it was, yeah.
So it's sort of that level of, you're not the family I wanted you to be, so I'm going to kill you instead of just leaving.
I know, yeah. And then he just, like, carried on with his life, didn't he?
Yeah, and he got away with it for, like, decades until they found him finally.
That's a wild case.
That is a wild one. Go check it out if you haven't, guys.
Yeah.
The next type is an anomic killer. This is where financial troubles can spur on a family annihilator. So in this case, the killer associates their family success as only being viable because of financial wealth. So if the wealth is then called into question or about to be taken away due to their perceived failure as the breadwinner, then the killer chooses familicide as the way to handle that situation.
Sounds like someone we know.
It all sounds so familiar.
Mm.
And finally, the last type is a paranoid killer. So, for example, a killer may believe there is an external threat to his family, like social services, and that they will lose their family forever if they get taken away.
Yeah.
And they just can't bear that. So they decide that the best way to keep them safe or protect the family in their mind from separation is by killing them.
Oh, it's so sad.
And as much as all this research from the last decade is truly fascinating, the reality is that understanding family annihilation is still very much in its early stages. So there's probably still a lot more to this topic that we don't quite understand yet, which is why it's so baffling to a lot of us and why family annihilation gets a lot of attention and why I find it probably one of the most fascinating psychological areas in forensic psychology.
Yeah, it definitely is. It is, like you said, one of those things where you just think, like, how could you do that?
Yeah.
And there's so many different reasons for it as well.
Absolutely. To me, it always sounds like a trigger point in some capacity.
Yeah.
That breaks something, you know, snaps.
It almost feels like it's never something that someone, like, grows up thinking, I'm going to do that.
Mm.
It's always, like, circumstances have led to.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, this is the only way I can handle the situation. It's a very warped way to handle any situation, but...
Oh, definitely.
They must come to a conclusion like that in their mind, that this is the only way I can deal with this.
Yeah.
Very fascinating, definitely.
Well, no, that was really interesting.
So, Amy, are you ready for your final question of the murder for money season?
Yes.
Ready?
I am ready.
My question for you is, how useful can CCTV footage be for evidence?
Well, Freya, let me tell you.
Do it, girl.
Well, so as we know, CCTV is pretty much everywhere nowadays. You kind of spot them all over the place when you're out and about.
Yeah, the pigeons.
The pigeons. They definitely are CCTV. And you'll even have people that have put up cameras on their houses to protect their homes from theft and such. So it's everywhere. As you can probably imagine, the use of CCTV is very helpful when it comes to investigating a crime, as it can provide video evidence if a crime is caught on the camera. Because of this, police officers from all over the globe are using CCTV footage in crime investigations. Most investigators use the footage to locate or confirm the identity of a suspect. They can also use it to determine whether an offence has occurred, observe relevant events surrounding incidents, corroborate victim statements, and generate other investigative leads.
It's the gold dust of investigations, isn't it? It's great to have CCTV.
Honestly, yeah. Because it is like you're seeing it happen.
Yeah.
You're seeing these things happen.
Can't get better than that. The best witness going.
Yeah. No bias.
No.
So a report shows that of 90 murder cases reported that year in Scotland, CCTV footage was used in 86 of the cases.
Oh, that's a lot of pigeons.
Go pigeons.
And like, I'm glad. I'm like, oh yeah, that's good. But then also I'm like, damn, can I go anywhere without anyone knowing where I am now?
Well, just don't commit a crime and you'll be all right.
I know. I just want to commit a crime. I just want some privacy, man.
Never.
That cult stuff sounds good.
Yeah. Still on it. Still on it.
10 episodes later and I'm still drifting back.
Oh my God, yeah. Can't believe that was before the season even started.
It was before the season. It was before Christmas specials. Yeah. Good times.
Crazy. Time flies.
When you're having fun and chatting about murder.
Oh, always. So according to the police officials, 65 cases were solved because the criminal was identified in the footage or the suspicious activities were recorded before or after their attacks. So quite handy.
Very.
So the recording may assist in determining who was in the crime either directly, such as the suspect is recognised by like their face, their clothes, or indirectly. So the footage might show where a criminal has touched a surface and then investigators can then go and try and recover forensic evidence from that surface, which I thought was quite interesting.
Ooh, that's smart.
Pretty cool.
I mean, it sounds pretty obvious, but I never even thought about that. Genius.
No, I know. I hadn't even thought about it either. So it can also help detectives in establishing a timeline and it can verify accuracy of statements. As CCTV footage could result in a guilty plea of the suspect, because obviously you can't really say, no, I didn't do that.
You can try.
Yeah, you can try. But it actually helps reduce costs by avoiding court trials, which is another reason why I'm sure police love it.
Yep.
Although CCTV evidence can seem like a convincing picture of what happened, it's not without its problems. So the position of the camera may mean details are not recorded, so you might only be seeing half of a crime scene.
Yeah, missing a perpetrator or something.
Yeah, you could be missing something that's really important that makes the context of the video make more sense.
Mm.
So you also have varying image quality because different types of CCTV cameras are used for like homes, venues, or business surveillance. So there's a huge variation in the quality. So you might not be able to actually really make anything out.
Or it could be like too far away and you can't determine if it's the person you think it is or just anyone with brown hair. And
well, yeah, exactly. So some cameras, they'll record HD video in real time, whereas others just take a series of intermittent still images. So it's not even really a video.
Oh, come on, get into the 21st century.
It's just like pictures taken every couple of seconds and put next to each other.
Yeah.
You could miss a crucial detail between those shots. Furthermore, many cameras only record black and white, which obviously doesn't really help if you want colour features.
Yeah.
So yeah, when the quality of the footage is poor, it can be very difficult to accurately identify the person in the images. So there are some techniques used, such as facial mapping.
Ooh.
This can be used to identify the subject of the CCTV by comparing facial proportions and the distances between their features to a known image of a suspect.
That is so cool.
I know, right? So it's like because of where your nose is compared to your eyes.
Yeah, I've seen like some programs about facial mapping and how they're trying to implement it everywhere. And I do find it very fascinating.
Yeah.
They also say that like because we willingly put selfies up on social media, like they're gathering that data to help make that technology even better.
Ah, well, it makes sense.
So every time we post selfies, we're actually improving the facial recognition software to help solve crimes.
Oh, I don't mind helping. I don't mind helping out.
Until it's you that's done a crime, Amy, and then you will mind.
Hey, I'm not doing one, it's fine.
Can we get that in writing?
Yeah, it's not me. But yeah, so that's only really helpful when you can see the face, which is the main problem with that one. So when there isn't a face, there are some other methods that can be used, such as a thing called gait analysis.
Mm.
So it's a forensic technique which involves tracking the unique way the subject of a recording walks and comparing it to a live subject to verify whether they are likely to be the same person.
Oh, I am going to walk in such a different way in public now.
I'm mixing it up now.
I'm going to be strolling. I'm going to have my shoulders all the way back. I'm going to swing my arms. Oh, man. They won't be able to know it's me. Never again.
Never. Never. Although you're going to have to change this about you as well, Freya. So they can also determine someone's height.
Oh, fuck.
By using frames taken from the camera.
I'm going to be in heels all the time.
But they can work it out, Freya. They can work it out.
I'm going to grow my hair upright.
There are many methods to do this. And to be honest, much of it includes too much mathematical geometry things for my brain.
I get that.
The simplified way that I know it is they can use items in the frame to determine the height.
Mm.
So say the person in the image is stood next to a fridge.
Yeah.
You could go and take the exact measurements of the fridge and then use this as a comparison tool for the person standing next to it to get the height.
That is clever.
So like that's the one that I remember, but I know that there's other like weird like using parallel lines all over the place and
numbers,
I don't know, angles and shit. I don't know. Stuff that I do not compute with.
I'm here for that. I'll just be like zoned out if you start talking down that line. I'm like, yeah.
I'm like, yeah, okay, can we move on now? Yeah.
Yeah, numbers.
But yeah, so those are some of the different things that you can do with CCTV and some of the issues.
So it's magic stuff. Truly magic.
It is.
I love it.
When it's helpful.
I mean, I imagine those that have to go through CCTV as like investigators must see some very chilling stuff. Like that woman that said in this case, watching him just, you know, kill the animals.
Yeah, how calm he was.
You must see some awful sides of humanity just playing out in front of you. Like it's a film, but it's real life.
Definitely, yeah.
Crazy.
So that's our final episode of Burning Questions.
Oh my God. The end of a season, the end of an era.
Emotional.
And it's time to end on some nice notes too.
Yes, let's do it.
Some nice lovely notes to keep you going until we meet again on the interweb.
On the social medias.
So what's your nice note, Amy? Your final nice note of the Murder for Money season.
Well, I think we can both agree that our nice note for finishing the season is all of our listeners, all of you guys out there listening to us.
It is 100%. You guys are the nicest subnotes we've ever done.
Definitely. Don't get emotional.
We just We just love you.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening.
And we just love all the support.
Yeah.
And, you know, people recommending us to friends. That's so, like, I can't believe people are doing that, to be honest.
It's mad. It's so beautiful. We send each other every time. We're like, someone likes us.
You like us?
It means so much. As any small podcaster knows, you know, it's so sweet to have people actually reach out and say that they like what you're doing.
Yeah, definitely.
It's so nice.
So we appreciate it all.
So you guys have been absolute gem. You know, we've grown from a consistent 3 to 5 listeners to a consistent 8 to 10.
Honestly, we're moving up in the world.
Next season we'll be back. Aims of it reaching the consistent 13 to 15 number.
Definitely. I mean, 15. Oof. That would be a dream.
Dare we dream? Dare we dream, Amy?
You have to in this world, Freya. You have to dream.
We do. You've all been just absolute gems, you know, and even though we will be gone for a little while as we prepare a new season for you.
Exciting.
We want you to know that you can still talk to us, still get in touch with us in the same places as normal.
You can find us on pretty much most social medias at A Killer Podcast. So like Instagram, Twitter, Facebook.
Yeah.
Is there other social medias?
We did join the TikTok, didn't we, recently?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I'm still behind on that.
Very behind.
It blows my mind.
Pet, we joined the TikTok, remember?
What is that? Is it a clock? Why are we in a clock?
The last I heard, it was a Keisha song.
Oh my god, yes. That was a great song.
Jam of our childhood.
Yeah.
But yeah, find us there and talk to us. Don't feel like we've abandoned you. We're still here, you know. We don't want you to abandon us either.
Still love us.
And you can also email us at killerpodcast@outlook.com. And yeah, if you've liked us this season, if you've liked us this episode, if you've liked us at all, just once, like a glimmering moment of likeness for us.
Hopefully you have.
Please rate and review us on Apple and Podchaser. Do they do it there? I think they do it there. They do some reviews.
Oof, too technical for me.
Just, if you like us and there's a place to like us, you know.
Show everyone.
Yeah, send the love our way. It would melt our hearts. And please keep recommending us to people and letting them know of this tiny little podcast.
Build our community. In the time that we're gone, you know, it's not like you haven't got anything to listen to. You can go back, listen to our first season either again,
yeah,
or for the first time, depending on how you found us. Got some really great 10 episodes there of crimes with a supernatural twist.
Absolutely. And of course, you've got the 10 episodes we've just created for Murder for Money. Go back if you've missed them. We've said it and we'll say it again. Go back.
We will keep saying it.
And as an extra special treat, you know, you can also go hit up our Halloween special. They are fun episodes. We had a lovely interview with author Joe Turner in our first part, and we covered a cult in the second part.
They were definitely one of my favourite episodes we've done.
Massively. I really enjoyed those. I've enjoyed them all.
All of them.
There's also our Christmas special. Again, we covered 2 very festive cases. You know, it's not Christmas, but it doesn't mean you can't listen to it.
Exactly.
Enjoy. Get festive.
Get festive all year round.
I guess that's it until we return again.
Yes. We will be back, and we'll actually be back on Valentine's Day. Valentine's Day special.
Ooh, romance.
Where I'm sure we're going to find some lovely, love-filled murders.
Perfect.
Yes. That's how it works.
If you've got no one to spend Valentine's with, spend it with us. If you've got someone to spend Valentine's with, ditch them, spend it with us.
Exactly.
And that's the rule.
Absolutely.
We look forward to sharing the love with you then.
Yes.
Until then, guys.
Have a killer time.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. You can find a full list of our resources used to create this episode at our website, witworld.co.uk/podcast.
That's witworld.co.uk.